This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political, social, economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this special issue for the holiday season, filled with stress and dietary indiscretions, we get the lowdown on GI distress from the pinnacles of tertiary care medicine. Dr. Jonathan Turdeman.
For a lot of the day-to-day problems, the answer are the simplest things.
And Dr. Dick Weisiker.
People don't like to look at abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation in terms of their lifestyle.
And Lathan Spaulding, who sets a good example.
Most of the time it's pretty good when I'm eating enough salad and greens.
First, let's talk about the flu. Those of us in the U.S. have had the luxury to witness the U.S. government's rigorous promotion of flu shots. It is interesting to note that since 2007, the Centers for Disease Control and the U.S. Department of Health Services have been working to develop non-pharmaceutical interventions because pharmaceutical interventions, such as vaccinations and antiviral medications, may not be available in sufficient quantities. It turns out there actually isn't enough flu vaccine to vaccinate all 6 billion plus of us. Looks like the majority of the people on the planet are going to need some other methods to prevent themselves from getting ill. Also turns out that the flu vaccine doesn't work 100% of the time. The CDC admits that even when the vaccine is thought to have the right strain of flu for that season, 10 to 20% of healthy adults under 65 will still get sick with the flu. The CDC also admits that even for older adults or people with a chronic illness, the flu shot is not effective in preventing hospitalization for the flu 30 to 70% of the time. Having said that, people who are at high risk for serious complications of the flu should be prioritized to receive the vaccine. The good news is that 9 out of Dr. Chander's top 10 strategies for cultivating your resilience to the flu are completely and entirely free. Number 1. Sleep a lot. Throw away your alarm clock and don't wake up until you are done sleeping. If you have to be somewhere where someone will miss you, then get your bum to bed super early. The January 2009 issue of the Archives of Internal Medicine reports on a study that looked at sleep duration and efficiency of 153 men and women before exposing them intentionally to a virus that is associated with the common cold. The researchers found that those who slept less than 8 hours a night were about 3 times more likely to develop a cold after being exposed to the virus. Number 2, manage your stress well. Scientists from Stanford, California have published a paper in Brain Behavior and Immunity in October 2009 showing how immune and stress responses relate to infection resistance and tolerance. In the same journal, in August of 2008, a paper from Loyola University of Chicago demonstrated how practicing mindfulness-based stress reduction has beneficial effects on the immune function. Number 3. Eat freshly cooked hot meals sitting down at a relaxed pace while doing absolutely nothing else. Diet is a very important regulator of the immune system. Number 4. Avoid all cold drinks and cold foods. Avoid high sugar foods and chocolate and caffeine. It's just too bad the holidays and their sweet treats coincide with the flu season. Number 5, get regular exercise. Mind-body forms of exercise like Tai Chi, Qigong, and yoga are best for strengthening and balancing the immune system and keeping it strong. And daily practice is the secret to success. Researchers from the University of Malaga in Spain reported in the June 2004 issue of the Medical Science Monitor on how the immune system changed after a Qigong training program in 29 people who had never practiced before. They found that after 1 month of practicing Qigong, there were significant immunological changes in the group who had practiced daily. Number 6, wash your hands frequently without becoming obsessive or compulsive about it. Do not turn a good health habit into a psychiatric disorder. Do not pick your nose or rub your eyes or stick your fingers in your mouth without washing your hands first. Turns out you don't need those alcohol-based sanitizers that come packaged in plastic bottles that will end up in your landfill, not mine. A study in the February 2009 issue of Clinical Infectious Diseases showed that soap and water hand washing was the most effective way to reduce the load of influenza A virus on your hands. Number 7, irrigate your nasal passages with warm saline solution daily, a procedure known as neti or nasya amongst yoga practitioners. The Cochrane Review indicates there is evidence that saline nasal irrigation is beneficial in the treatment of the symptoms of colds. The yogic tradition recommends it daily as a method of preventing catching a cold. Number 8, dress warmly. The flu season is the time to dress for the weather. A warm, healthy body impresses everyone. Number 9, avoid close contact with those who have the flu. Number 10, at the first inkling that you might be getting sick, stay home from work or school, cancel any other plans, and get lots of extra rest. And don't go back to work or school until you are sure you don't have the flu. Adjust your priorities so you can breeze through the flu season unscathed. Number 11 is a freebie and is a no-brainer. Do not smoke. Dr. Jonathan Turdeman is professor of gastroenterology at UCSF. His interests are in Crohn's disease, colitis, and hereditary cancer prevention. He shared his thoughts on the prevention of stomach problems from the lobby of a yoga studio. Dr. Turdeman, you're a gastroenterologist. Can you tell us some things that we as individuals and we as a society can do to prevent the most common problems that we experience in our GI tract?
Well, gastrointestinal complaints are really common. At least 20 to 30% of the population has difficulties or troubles often. The GI tract, it's the main interface with the outside world. The typical surface area of skin is interacting with the outside world. It's like a meter squared of skin or a meter and a half. But the GI tract is, you know, many hundredfold that.
That's such a weird thing to think about, that the GI tract is really still the outside world, being inside your belly.
It's pretty fascinating, but it is the main place that we interact with the other, and we do a lot of interacting with the other. In fact, if you take your whole self and you totaled up all the number of cells, there's many more other cells in you than your own cells in terms of bacteria and all of the organisms. So manipulating that for good or for bad is a major cause of the day-to-day GI problems. In modern medicine, we're just beginning to understand about how to best interact with that outside world. Probably a key part of this is what we call the microbiome, or the bacteria and organisms that live inside. And so we know that there are certain ones that are better for you and certain that are more harmful or more likely to cause GI symptoms. And what determines that partly is the environment that you live in, but the most important thing is what you eat. So there's this, we call it prebiotic, meaning the food that you put inside directly impacts on the organisms that live in you and their kind of relative numbers.
This is a new word. I've never heard prebiotic. I've heard probiotic. I've heard antibiotic. Could you explain that a little bit more?
These living organisms that are inside your GI tract, you're eating, they're eating. When you eat, that in a great part determines your individual microbe. We call it the microbiome. Literally billions of organisms, many haven't even been speciated. But what you put in is the biggest thing that determines what's in there. Diets that have large amounts of refined sugars, processed food, corn syrup, those sorts of things have a deleterious negative impact on that microbiome. There's definitely this connection between eating foods that have a lot of created nutrients, these simple sugars that we really aren't supposed to have in our diet, like fructose and pure sucrose, and the bacteria love that stuff. You end up growing up higher numbers than there should be. And more importantly, there's some sort of imbalance.
So one of the main things is to avoid the simple sugars in terms of diet.
Absolutely.
A lot of people have reflux and hyperacidity. Is there any primary prevention thing that we as individuals or as a society can do?
I mean, acid is supposed to be in the stomach. and it does help for digestion. And in fact, this huge industry of reducing acid, you know, those are the biggest selling drugs in the United States, are the acid reducing, what they're called the proton pump inhibitors. They also have a negative impact on your microenvironment because acid has some benefits. So it's not a bad thing. It's actually a natural thing. It actually keeps down bacteria levels. So when we do things to manipulate that, it doesn't always work out that well. Acid's supposed to stay in the stomach. It's not supposed to go back up into the esophagus. That's what we call reflux disease. There is a barrier to the reflux. There's a sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach. We know certain things weaken that sphincter. That includes tobacco use in any form, smoked or otherwise. Caffeine, alcohol are probably the most important, but other things include really high fat food, large amounts of things like chocolate, mints. Those have some direct activity on weakening the sphincter. That's reflux. But these themes kind of run through all of the areas of GI dysfunction.
Basically, you're saying people need to stop smoking, people need to stop drinking, people need to stop eating high fatty foods, caffeine.
Yeah, it's not easy to correct their habits or their, some cases, their addictions. You do the best you can with the things that are the most injurious and moderate the things that you can't completely eliminate. And if you are afflicted with the symptoms, you have to balance what's the pleasure you're getting out of Act A compared to the symptom that you get. People aren't always aware that there's such a direct connection. When they're aware, they're like, wow, it's not worth it. And I think a lot of people are unaware of some of the negatives of using the medicines. It's not that medicines uniformly shouldn't be used, but it's probably not the right approach to say, well, I'm going to stay with all of these behavioral issues and then just use the medicine.
Because that's what you feel like. Well, I can just keep smoking and then just pop this pill and I'll be fine.
Right. It ends up kind of being a vicious cycle. The medicine itself has some negative effects, and in the long run, it's not a good strategy. That's for sure.
What about stress?
Stress plays a big role in gut function. There's clearly a connection between stress and the level of certain neurotransmitters and hormones, and that has to do with the motility and neural function of the GI tract. When things don't squeeze and there's stasis, then there's more bacteria. Then the bacteria themselves cause some of the same problem. It's a bit of a vicious cycle. Stress messes up your immune responses, and so your communication with that microenvironment goes a little bit awry. It's really intertwined thing between what you put inside yourself, what's living there anyway, how you interact with that through your body surfaces and the immune system.
The complex integrated system that works well when it's working well.
Exactly. But it doesn't work well for a lot of people, especially living in the United States. If you just watch TV for a half hour, you see all the advertisements for GI remedies, and that's because the GI tract is a notorious place for things not functioning well. It's not purely driven by pharmaceutical dollars. It is in response to lots of low-level and higher-level suffering. But again, a lot of that is things that can be improved without necessarily relying on all of the vast array of medications that are out there.
We have a lot of advertising for antacids, and we have a lot of advertising for laxatives, but we also have a lot of advertising for cigarettes and for alcohol and coffee.
Correct.
And a lot of advertising for living beyond our means, which causes us a lot of stress. It's a whole complex system of advertising also.
Very complex, that's right. And some of the remedies that are suggested are short-term fixes, but then they don't really provide great long-term solutions and end up injuring the system or perturbing it. It's kind of like you have a shift to the right, and so you use something to, you know, shift it back to the left, and you overshift it that way, and you correct it back the other way, and you end up like doing four things to get to the center when the easiest thing was to like just be in the center.
What about constipation? What do we do to prevent that?
Well, again, key is what you eat. There's no doubt that fiber in your diet, eating a sufficient amount of trees and leaves, that plus an adequate amount of fluid, hydration, exercise, that's the answer for the majority.
Trees and leaves come in the form of fruits and vegetables.
Exactly. They look like trees and leaves. So it's like lettuce and spinach and cabbage and bok choy and broccoli and celery. It's pretty obvious.
Right on.
How it ties all together. So if you are constipated because you don't have enough fiber, then when things don't move through, that's what bacteria love. Things sit there, they eat it, they grow in number. A byproduct of their metabolism is gas. And so you end up with excess gas and bloating. That's irritable bowel syndrome.
You're kind of an unusual gastroenterologist. These are things you don't need to be a specialist to recommend. I mean, you eat well, exercise, drink enough water, stay relaxed.
I had to do a lot of studying to figure out these simple things. Most patients are, as I said, using this product to correct that problem, and then they get a side effect from that product, and so they use another product, and you end up with polypharmacy. By no means am I a complete nihilist for medications. There are circumstances where pharmaceuticals are the right answer and the key, but for a lot of the day-to-day problems, the answer are the simplest things. And, you know, I've tried a lot of the complicated things, and they don't work as well. But I've been a practitioner for a while. It took a while to figure out.
That's great. I'm so pleased. I have one more question. Seems like they can prevent colon cancer by getting a colonoscopy every however many years. And when I think of it at a global level, if I think about every person on the planet getting a colonoscopy every so-and-so number of years, it kind of doesn't seem like a real practical way to prevent colon cancer.
Well, there's different kinds of prevention. So there's primary prevention, which is not colonoscopy. We call that secondary prevention. The best thing, of course, is primary prevention.
Let me just explain that, because that's a beautiful point you're making. Primary prevention is you do things that prevent you from ever getting a problem. Secondary prevention is you find the problem early and nip it in the bud.
Exactly. So generally, in this country, primary prevention has been ignored. The secondary prevention ends up being very valuable. We're able to find these little precancerous lesions, the polyps. Okay. We know in the United States, colorectal cancer is extremely common. It's the fourth most common cancer and the second leading cause of cancer death. It's actually still, for example, a rare cancer in places like southern India. There is a big environmental difference. Now, it doesn't mean everything's perfect in southern India, because there's other cancers that are very common there that aren't common here. Eating these high-fiber diets, eating a diet with lots of legumes and certain kinds of micronutrients, calcium, right amount of folic acid and other things, vitamin supplements doesn't work as well as trying to just get the right micronutrients out of the healthy foods. You can't reduce a healthy diet into its constituent parts very easily. We're not smart enough to do it.
Can't just take a calcium supplement instead of drinking milk.
Exactly. And you can't just say, oh, I need this vitamin, this vitamin, this vitamin, this vitamin, because you're missing them and you're not getting them in the right proportions. You need to eat the food that has them naturally. Diets that have high amounts of fat, probably high amounts of the sugars, low amounts of natural fiber, definitely are pro-cancerous, especially in the colon. If you just look worldwide, there's huge variations in colorectal cancer. You'll have an incident rate in certain places many-fold less than this country. So you get off to a much better start in terms of primary prevention. There's a oncologist at UCSF named Donald Abrams. He's a very well-known oncologist, was famous for treating lymphomas, which is a cancer of the lymph nodes and blood cells, with very potent chemotherapy drugs. He now, I think he calls himself like an oncological ecologist. He feels very strongly that what you try to do is make the soil as inhospitable to cancer as you can with the right sort of diet. If you already have a cancer, you probably can make great strides in helping to keep it under control or to cure it or to even assist in making sure that the medications are helping and also to prevent it from occurring at all.
That's fantastic. There's also some studies from the University of Iowa for people with inflammatory bowel conditions like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. They're using the cysts of a parasite to reduce the inflammation in the gut.
Now you've hit on my favorite topic of all. Okay, so my real specialty is in the treatment of something called inflammatory bowel disease. That's a set of conditions where that interaction between the microenvironment and your intestine and your intestinal immune system has gone completely haywire. Normally, your immune system is happy. It's like, oh, those are the organisms I'm meant to coexist with. And in inflammatory bowel disease, the immune system reacts against the quote-unquote normal environment, and you end up with inflammation, and the bowel is injured. Traditionally, we spend a lot of time treating inflammatory bowel disease with drugs that stop immune function. And that makes some sense, right? Because the immune response is overactive. But those drugs have a lot of toxic side effects and an impact on your immunity in general, even to fight off the things that it should be fighting off. The immune diseases are epidemic now in the quote-unquote developed world, in the modern, hygienic, sterilized, processed world. We've eliminated certain infectious illnesses, but we have an absolute epidemic now of immune disorders like inflammatory bowel disease, asthma, lupus, multiple sclerosis, type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis. These are the afflictions of modern man. And those are illnesses are rare in other parts of the world that aren't quite so processed, hygienic, what have you. So we're doing something to the environment that's provoking. It's bringing out this immune dysregulation. One possible thing, and this is the study you're talking to, has to do with actually worms. Some worms cause disease. They're not good. It's good to get rid of them. But that's not necessarily the case with all worms. About 1 billion people on the earth have worms.
A worm in your intestine.
Exactly, like hookworm.
Mostly all over the world, you get them as a kid.
You get them as a kid, and when some of these natural quote-unquote infections don't occur early in life, you prime the immune system later in life to inappropriately overreact. The science behind this is pretty rigorous. So what people are looking at now is going back and actually infecting people with things that we would have said, oh my God, that must cause disease. That's got to be a bad thing. But it turns out it's not necessarily so bad. The case you're talking about, people are using worm eggs as opposed to the worms. And when you swallow a capsule of the worm eggs, the reaction is to turn off the immune response in the gut and reduce the inflammation. There's a lot of increasingly good evidence that it actually is a pretty good therapy for inflammatory bowel disease, maybe as good, almost certainly safer than the treatments with the super strong drugs.
So most of those people are actually getting relief from their inflammatory bowel condition.
Yeah. I've actually had some patients who have very bad Crohn's disease, who have tried and failed all the most potent medicines, and they, on their own, have infected themselves with hookworm. That's a living worm, and in small numbers, it doesn't cause a lot of human disease. And we've seen some really interesting, kind of promising responses, better than we saw with some of the really strong drugs. But I'm convinced knowing more about that inside environment, making sure that it as good as it can be, best by natural means, the prebiotic way, but even potentially by a more interactive probiotic way, is probably the key to really reducing a lot of these troubles, especially from these immune disorders.
Well, a lot of times also those worms and parasites don't cause any symptoms as long as the person is already pretty strong and well-nourished and has some resilience. If they're kind of weak or stressed or debilitated, they can cause more symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have to be careful. There's lots of children in the world who die of diarrheal illness. That's an extremely rare occurrence in the United States. We've manipulated the environment in ways that's a very unusual. That sounds good, and it is good. At the same time, that manipulation has led to a whole host of other problems that are maybe as equally damaging to the population. This idea of everything that's hygienic is best and great, it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, like putting antibiotics in soaps and laundry detergents may not be such a wise idea if we're worried about over-sanitizing our environment.
Exactly. People are now more and more aware that there's a fallout from that and figuring out kind of better ways to avoid some of the bad but not eliminate the good.
That's great. Can you speak very briefly about probiotics? You can buy them over the counter now. Some of them are in the refrigerator. Some of them are out of the refrigerator. Should we be using them? What's the story?
Well, again, I think that the idea behind them is really good. There's a big array of them, so you have to know your products. Some are high quality, have in them what they say they have in them, and others don't. So there's a little bit of that just buyer beware stuff. But in the general idea, again, is manipulating that microenvironment in a positive way. And there is a lot of science and pre-science that says that that's positive and helpful. And it is. I think probiotics probably in general are more good than bad. The prebiotic way is the better way.
Getting everything through your food.
Because if you eat properly, the microenvironment is going to kind of correct itself.
Part of it also is that we use antibiotics so much. Even if you're eating well, you're wiping out a lot of the normal flora.
That's right. So I think ultimately when we kind of have a good sense of like what is the most optimal normal flora, we'll be able to manipulate it. We're not quite there yet. When you try to do it yourself, I think you can do good. Ultimately, the better strategy is to build it from the ground up as opposed to doing it kind of after the fact.
It's been really great, really informative to talk to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Turdeman.
My pleasure, Jayshree. It was great to talk to you.
Dr. Jonathan Turdeman, Professor of Gastroenterology at UCSF. Dr. Weisiger is a full professor in gastroenterology at UCSF. His interests are in brain stress pathways and how they relate to GI disorders. I spoke with him in his office on the Parnassus Hill in San Francisco. Dr. Weisiger, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Happy to do it.
You're a gastroenterologist, and I'd love to have your perspective on primary prevention on the common gastrointestinal disorders, dyspepsia, reflux, constipation, irritable bowel syndrome, those kinds of things.
Generally, my philosophy is that if you follow a lifestyle that is close to that which we evolved to follow thousands of years ago, that's the lifestyle that your body is really set to live, and you're more likely to be healthy than you are if you try to push yourself into areas that you're not really set up to handle. I like to draw an analogy between humans who live on the land, whales who live in the ocean, and bats who live in caves. I mean, we're all mammals, but we've evolved to live in very different environments. You take a bat and put it in the ocean, it dies. You take a whale in a cave, well, you might not even be able to fit it in. Likewise, humans evolved to live a relaxed life on a savanna. When we try to live a different lifestyle, that's often where we start to get in trouble. We eat a different diet. We push ourselves to do a second job, or we get into a very stressful circumstance because of money or interpersonal relationships. Increasingly, we raise our children in isolation from supporting members of our family, which historically was not the case. All of these things can cause gastrointestinal effects, ranging from abdominal pain to diarrhea, constipation, bloating, nausea, vomiting. Now, obviously, there are many other disorders that don't have to do with lifestyle, but even there, things like infections or ulcers, you're more likely to get sick if you are pushing yourself, if you are not taking care of your body, if you are not giving yourself enough time to relax and regenerate.
Why would you be more prone to get an infection if you're not relaxed?
The immune system is there to help kill bacteria, but when we're under stress, we release stress hormones that suppress the immune system. Cortisone is the best known stress hormone. And cortisone basically turns off your immune system. Your body has taken the approach, well, our life is in danger or we wouldn't be under such great stress. This is not a good time to worry about, you know, killing this minor infection. We'll just put it off for now. And so it's very common that people will have problems with infections when they're under severe stress. There's even some evidence that you're more likely to get cancer within a year after your wife or husband dies, presumably due to the higher level of stress in making that adjustment.
Right. Primarily, the stress is causing a imbalance in your hormonal system.
Hormones are one aspect of it. The brain has control of the gastrointestinal system through nerves as well. There's the autonomic nervous system, which has nerves that calm the GI system and make it underdo its normal digestion. Those are the vagus nerves. And then we have autonomic nerves that are sympathetic, that normally fire when we're excited or stressed or frightened. And these shut down the gastrointestinal system, which makes sense. Again, if you're running away from danger, this is not a time to be doing a lot of digestion. You need the blood flow for other purposes to help you escape whatever danger you're running from. The brain sends these signals to the gut, and the gut responds like it's supposed to, depending on the circumstance that you're in.
So can we get into a little bit of the specifics about stress and ulcers?
Well, you know, ulcers have long had a reputation for being caused by stress. In animal studies, if you take an animal and put it under severe stress, you can cause ulcers in that animal, and I imagine the same would be true in humans, but that's a very extreme level of stress.
Would you say that's the same story for dyspepsia, just the heartburn people experience?
Dyspepsia is a very broad category that can have many causes. And you've already mentioned heartburn, which is caused by reflux of acid from the stomach up into the esophagus, where it causes irritation. But many people will get dyspepsia for other reasons. It can simply be caused by the stomach churning, again, which can be brought on by stress. It can be caused by disorders in the ability of the stomach to relax when you eat. Some people have trouble relaxing their stomachs. These are areas that are not well understood, but all of them can present complaining of discomfort in the area of the stomach, which is what we call dyspepsia.
Have you ever noticed that people oftentimes complain of burning in their stomach after a period of stress is over?
Well, many of my patients are under stress all the time, and I wonder a little bit if you're just starting to pay attention. The discomfort may have been there all along, but you are too busy, and then when you finally have a chance to sit down and relax and take inventory, you begin to notice that, oh yes, I've got these abdominal problems. So nature has a way of not telling you about your problems if you're in danger. Stress generally means that your life is in danger. We didn't evolve to deal with financial stress or relationship stress. We evolved to deal with forest fires and floods and attacks by the neighboring tribe, and that's what stress prepares us to deal with.
How does it work with constipation?
Well, constipation has several causes. In general, a lot of constipation can be blamed on diet. We eat much less fiber in our diet than our ancestors did. And it's an important part of your diet, both in terms of making sure that your stool stays soft and in terms of providing nutrients to the lining of the colon. Because when the bacteria break down the fiber, they produce something called short-chain fatty acids, which is an important fuel for keeping the colon healthy. One reason we get constipated is we don't eat enough fruits, vegetables, and fiber that our gastrointestinal system was designed to eat. We were not designed to eat meat. We have a long GI tract like most other vegetarian animals. So historically, you know, other than the occasional rat that you caught, you know, you didn't eat a lot of meat. So when we eat a high meat, low vegetable, low grain diet, we are stressing ourselves by trying to do something that we weren't designed to do. Now, the other things that can cause constipation, again, is stress. When you are in stress, some people will get diarrhea, some people will get constipation, some people will get even nausea and vomiting, most people will feel bloated.
Man, the whole thing seems to be directly tied to how relaxed you can remain.
Stress, relaxation are important for all aspects of human health, but for whatever reason, the gastrointestinal system is where it often shows up. And so people who practice gastrointestinal medicine, such as myself, see a lot of people who are actually there because they're getting a divorce, because they just broke up with their boyfriend. When you can help the patient realize their mind and their body are interacting in this way, that's the first step to taking a more organic approach to the problem rather than just popping pills, which may or may not help, to actually correcting the underlying cause of the problem.
Absolutely. Very well said. I mean, I know for me, I started having doubling over abdominal pain when I was in medical school, and it pretty much happened after every single exam. Endoscopy showed that I had developed an ulcer, and I started taking antacids, and the pain would be fine as long as I was taking the antacids, and as soon as I'd stop, then the pain was back because I hadn't done anything in my life to change my life.
Well, so medical school can be very stressful, and stress can cause a condition called irritable bowel syndrome. The only time in my life that I've ever had irritable bowel syndrome was when I was in medical school before the first examination of the year, which happened to be in gross anatomy, and I was terrified. I had no idea whether I was as good as my peers, and I had pain and diarrhea, which is one of the symptoms of irritable bowel. Well, my daughter got married a week and a half ago, and I got to give the father's speech at the reception. I can tell you that I have diarrhea predominant irritable bowel because after 30 years, my diarrhea came back with all the stress associated with that as well. It is something that happens to everybody, including doctors.
How do you advise your patients that come to you?
Well, stress can be caused by all sorts of things. Some of them are avoidable. Having said that, a lot of stress comes from worrying about things that haven't happened yet, or going over and over things that in the past have happened that have been painful and still raise your fear response, your anger response. And so most people advise practices to settle the mind and deal with stress that fall into the category of mindfulness. It is being mindful of the present, is paying attention to what's going on right now in your life. Usually what's happening right now is not terribly stressful. Being aware of your body, being aware of, you know, the wind, the smells, the sounds. And when you stay in the present, that's usually a pretty relaxed time. So in addition to the things I've just mentioned, regular exercise is good for your mind as well as your body. I'm not talking about joining the gym and knocking yourself out, but if you can get out and walk for half an hour or whatever you can do several times a week, that will help a lot. Buy yourself a shiny new bicycle and explore the neighborhood. Get involved in dancing or sports or swimming or whatever you like to do. That's very good for stress. And then in the realm of mindfulness, we recommend yoga, which is easy to do. It's available at the local YMCA. You can get a DVD if you can't find the show on television already. And I recommend something called mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a kind of meditation, which is basically sitting still and paying attention to your body. I've taken the course. I found it very helpful. I told my wife she ought to take it. She found it so helpful, she actually has taken additional training, and now she's teaching it.
Wow.
I've sent a number of my patients to the course, and I've gotten feedback from many of them who found it very useful as well.
So how does it work? I mean, there's been studies looking at how meditation affects the brain. They'll do MRIs while, you know, the Dalai Lama's meditating. Are they looking at how meditation's affecting the functioning of the GI tract?
I don't know how it works. It's important to know that it does work, and it's nice to know there's some mysteries and some questions that still haven't been answered. I will say, however, that some people say, oh, well, it's not in my mind, doctor. This is real pain. You know, I'm not imagining it, thinking that meditation, mindfulness would only work for imagined pain, that if I really had an ulcer, I really had something serious, that there's no way it would work. And that's not the case at all. Jon Kabat-Zinn got his start in Boston asking people to send him the patients that couldn't be helped by standard medicine. And he said, send me your cancer patients who have cancer in their bones and they're in terrible pain and they're dying and there's nothing you can do for them. Send me the folks who've been in terrible accidents and their spine is all broken in multiple places and they can't move without pain. And he's shown that even when the physical pain is still there, somehow the process, mindfulness, stress reduction, makes the pain more tolerable. Somehow you're able to coexist with the pain. Instead of the pain overwhelming you, you somehow are able to go on and live your life and have satisfactory interactions with other people and do things that you take pleasure in, despite the fact that the pain's still there. So it's not a matter of teaching you not to have the pain. It's a matter of your developing a new kind of relationship with whatever it is that's causing you discomfort.
Sort of gives you an inner strength to be able to deal with the pain.
You could view it as an inner strength, sure. Although I don't think of it as my overcoming the pain. I think of it more as my coexisting with the pain.
Yeah, so you can just manage it. I mean, you can handle it even though it hurts.
Well, it goes beyond the bowel. It really goes to the core of stress. Back when stress meant life-threatening events, such as you're being stalked by a tiger, you're escaping a flood, your ability to respond to stress is critical. This is also very important for very young people, because if you lose a parent, you know, or for whatever reason you're left on your own as a child, whether or not you survive and have children, which is all evolution really cares about, depends a lot on how you deal with the dangers around you. And it turns out that nature has built in a very elegant mechanism in which early childhood stresses can cause a permanent upregulation of the brain's stress response. And for years, nobody understood what was going on. Finally, what we discovered was that there was a change that occurred in the DNA of the brain, the receptor in the brain, the part of the brain that's sensitive to the stress hormone cortisol, becomes insensitive, so that the adrenal gland has to make more and more and more cortisol to turn off the stress response. The fact is that early childhood neglect and in early childhood abuse can cause permanent upregulation of the stress response. Animals and humans who have a history of early childhood neglect or abuse tend to be more likely to be anxious. They tend to sleep poorly, be depressed more often. Of course, if you're living in a dangerous environment, depression may actually be adaptive.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing here is that we're talking about the inheritance of acquired characteristics. The Russian Lamarck had a Lamarckian inheritance model in which he postulated that giraffes get long necks by stretching to reach the leaves, and that the more they stretch, the longer their necks get. And then when they had children, that was somehow carried on to the children. What we're talking about here really is Lamarckian evolution. We are able to pass on to our offspring acquired characteristics of, in this case, behavior in response to danger.
That's excellent. There's something in the Kabbalah. If you heal something within yourself, you heal it for all your descendants and all your ancestors.
Yeah. All right. That's a very deep, and I'll have to think about that because I'm not familiar with it. But I do know from my experience that there are a lot of problems that run in families that you inherit a problem, an inability to deal with a certain issue. And unfortunately, physical abuse of children is one of those. If you were abused as a child, you are much more likely, you'd think you'd be more sensitive, but somehow it makes you more likely to abuse your own children. If you are the one that is able to break that pattern, your children and your children's children and so on down the line will benefit.
Yeah, and same with anxiety or depression or alcoholism or smoking, or if you quit smoking, your children are less likely to smoke.
Yeah, it's so important that once we've identified that we have a problem, we seek help. We shouldn't be embarrassed, whether it's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a pastor, or a friend.
It's very profound what you're talking about. And I also really appreciate the way you say it, that there's a response to stress. We're living lives now that we can't eliminate stress. We only can change how we're responding to stress.
Right. Yeah, it would be nice if we could better adapt our environment rather than putting all of the adaptation on ourselves. We can give ourselves a little bit of credit for doing as well as we do under the circumstances.
Well, and I think also there are certain measures that people can take to change their environment. You mentioned some of them at the beginning, you know, changing your job or working part-time or changing your living situation or maybe changing your quote-unquote needs so that you don't have as many financial stressors or strains. You know, you can decrease your standard of living and increase your quality of life.
You shouldn't put such great priority on certain aspects of success that you sacrifice happiness, relaxation, the important things in life.
Yeah, and that's where we come down to prioritizing your well-being. There's no real point in being at the top of the heap with a bellyache.
That's true. I suspect if you did a proper interview of most people that are highly successful, and you'll find that they're too busy with what they're doing to really enjoy their lives. In many ways, they're less happy because of the imperatives that they feel than someone who is superficially less successful.
All we need to do is change the definition of success.
Yeah, I think that's a very appropriate way to go at it.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about common GI complaints and your experience as a gastroenterologist?
Many people I see are so worried that they have some terrible disorder that hasn't been diagnosed that worrying about their illness is part of their stress. People don't like to look at abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation in terms of their lifestyle. They like to think of it in terms of pills and infections and ulcers and so on.
Changing your lifestyle is about changing your habits, and your habits come up through such a complex interaction of society and expectations and demands and coping mechanisms. So it's very difficult to change your lifestyle and change your habits without sort of some network social support.
Absolutely. It's very hard. Once you find yourself in a difficult circumstance, it's not something you can fix right away. I happen to believe that everybody can benefit from psychotherapy or just a life coach, somebody who comes in and looks at how you're doing and say, well, you know, you're doing pretty well, but why don't you consider doing this? Or, you know, you need to get out dancing more. You need a certain amount of time to relax and regenerate and get back to your equilibrium. And if you don't allow yourself or can't find that time, eventually you may end up with some of these functional GI disorders.
Yes, absolutely. Very well said. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. You've been very informative and offered a very refreshing perspective from the pinnacle of tertiary care medicine.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to seeing you in the future.
Thank you. Dr. Weisiger, professor of gastroenterology at UCSF.
Tari kita di kratin dina na ti kratin na tari kita dina katta dina gada tari kita dhati te gena to na krede te te gena to na krede ta gena te ta gena to na gena ta kita te kata kita te kata te te kata kadi gena ta te te kata kadi gena ta te te kata kadi gena ta.
Lathan Spaulding works as a carpenter and an apprentice boat builder. He very generously and unabashedly shares with us how he's able to maintain the regularity of his bowel function. Lathan, I'm so glad you're going to share with us the details about your digestion and elimination.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Can you tell us how things go for you?
Yeah. As far as my bowel movements, they're pretty regular. I usually wake up, and the first thing I do, a lot of times it wakes me up out of bed.
Wow, that's impressive.
Is it?
A lot of times people wake up because they have the sensation that they need to go pee, but generally it takes them a little while to warm up to having the sensation to go poo.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you're just different that way.
I guess so.
So you get the sensation that you got to poo, and that's kind of what wakes you up often.
Yes. And then if I'm smart, I'll act on it. I live on a boat, and the bathroom is 100 yards away, so sometimes I'm a little reluctant to act on it.
You don't want to get out of bed. It's nice and cozy.
Exactly. But I find if I don't, then the sensation goes away, and I might miss the chance. And I might not make a movement until the next day, or it's not good.
So if you miss it, then you've kind of missed it for the day.
Yeah, in an obvious way. If I do miss it, I try to maybe just think about it and let it come again, and maybe go just sit on the toilet and see if it'll happen on its own. And a lot of times it will, but I have to make the extra effort, you know, which sometimes hard when I'm busy.
It's very interesting. Well, you know, one of the Ayurvedic principles is that one should never hold back a certain number of urges. Mm-hmm. And one of those urges is the urge to defecate. So if you feel like you got to go, you should make the time and take the time to go. Same with urinating or coughing or sneezing or burping, farting, laughing, crying. Those are things that one should not hold back on.
Yeah, it seems to make sense. I mean, the body is wanting to do this for a reason, a way of taking care of itself, I think, if we wake up to it.
So when you do go, what's it like?
I mean, it varies. Lately, it's been kind of restricted, not fully developed. I think it's a little bit of indigestion.
Can you explain what you mean, restricted or not fully developed?
Like just a smaller movement. That's really loose and, yeah, it just doesn't seem to fill up the colon completely and then come out together as a solid piece. I haven't quite pinned it yet, but I'm thinking as I'm getting older, I'm getting more sensitive to certain foods.
Or maybe just as you get older, you pay more attention to your poop.
Maybe.
When did these less than satisfying movements begin for you?
Oh, it's not, it's so clear cut like that. It's just kind of off and on at different times when I think I'm not eating as healthy as I could be. Most of the time it's pretty good when I'm eating enough salad and greens, I find that I have a nice healthy movement, and it's, yeah, I mean,
it's formed large and satisfying.
Yeah, I guess. Who's to say which is good or which is bad? I don't know. I guess that's for the doctors to say.
Well, maybe not good or bad, but just that you notice a relationship between what you eat and how things go for you.
Yeah. I guess there is the actual experience. There's actually, yeah, the satisfying movement where you feel like it was just nice and easy, and it was just
a complete evacuation.
Yeah. And not where you felt like you had a lot of resistance from the body and it's kind of confused on when to stop or when to begin.
Or that you're not completely cleaned out.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed any relationship between things going on in your life or stress or activities or things going on in the world and that relationship with how things go for you?
It'd be something I should probably write a journal about if I really wanted to become more in touch with.
Or publish a book.
I don't know, yeah. The biggest thing I think about is just what I'm eating and getting enough water.
So you haven't noticed a relationship between mood or...
It's something I'm sure has a relationship to it, but it hasn't been something I've focused on. But maybe I should. It'd be interesting to see.
How would you describe your digestion before things get to the colon and move on out?
I think it's pretty healthy. I don't have a lot of gas. I think my digestion is pretty strong.
Nice. Very nice.
I'm lucky. All that salad.
So have your bowel movements changed along the way? I mean, as far back as you can remember?
Yeah, they have. I think I used to have more bowel movements when I didn't live on the boat. Not having a toilet readily accessible and it being a private toilet has definitely changed my movements.
So that you have less of them?
Yes. I mean, I used to have at least 2 and sometimes 3.
Wow, that's impressive.
I think I used to have more movements. I was more active physically.
Well, that's an interesting issue that you bring up about having a toilet and having some privacy. I'm just thinking on a global level about how many people in the world actually are living on sidewalks and are living in wild places where they don't have toilets. Or traveling through Asia, you often see people in the morning on the railroad tracks or by the side of the street or by the riverbank.
Yeah, I mean, the mood thing, I guess I notice if I don't have a regular elimination, I do feel a little kind of out of sorts.
A little grumpy.
Maybe grumpy or just kind of not very light or energized or in a very productive space.
Interesting. Have you ever done any colon cleansing and anything like that?
No, I haven't.
Well, I hear people talk about how they feel after a colon cleanse and they feel light and energetic and how they use these same words that you're using to describe how you feel after you've evacuated.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of times you take it for granted, and most of the time I think I do, and it's just the times when I've maybe missed a few movements in a couple of days, and then my body finally eliminates. And you're like, wow, that makes a real difference.
That's great that you notice it.
Yeah, so I can only imagine what people who don't have the space to make a proper elimination or feel comfortable and how that must mess with their whole social interaction. And
absolutely. You're a dedicated meditator as well, aren't you, Lathan? Have you noticed how meditation affects your bowel movements?
Well, I notice if I don't go eliminate immediately in the morning and choose to do my sitting practice and wait to go use the restroom, I think it really does affect my meditation. My mind isn't as clear, not as able to focus as well as if I go make a movement first. Not so much the meditation affecting my movements, but the movements affecting the meditation.
That's kind of the same lightness and clarity that you're talking about.
I guess so, yeah.
Clearly, your mental space and clarity and lightness and capacity for concentration seems to be very much related to how your colon is functioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the body's a mysterious thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, you also have sat in meditation courses, retreats, where you're sitting and meditating for 10 hours a day, 10 days at a time, maybe even longer. Have you noticed how your bowel movements change during that time?
I think just maybe the schedule. My movements are already regular, so the only thing that might happen is they change to a different hour of the day because my eating habit has changed and become more regular. I think it's kind of a mental thing, too. I choose a time when it's more comfortable, when there's less people around, less people in the restroom. You know, my moment that's comfortable and private.
Yeah, it's nice to not share everything.
It's interesting because I feel like I really don't have a problem per se in my ideology. I guess it's just there's some tightness or some restriction that happens when there's other people around.
At least in India, there's kind of a saying there are certain things that kind of should be done in private, and that includes elimination.
When they talk about private, I mean behind closed doors.
Yeah, it's not a public activity.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I obviously feel it in the body.
I mean, we kind of manage in public restrooms. They still have these partitions that give an illusion that you're by yourself.
And that you're anonymous.
Yeah, until you walk out of the stall.
Oh, I just wait until they're all gone.
I've heard of bashful bladders, and what would be the word for the coy colon?
I don't know.
Do you have anything else that you've noticed about your digestion and elimination?
I think a lack of water for me is probably the biggest issue. Spicy food, too. Food does something, and I think the body just tightens up around it.
And you get constipated or you get diarrhea?
Kind of both, I guess. And it's kind of just a really bad elimination that never feels quite complete.
Lathan, do you have anything else you'd like to share with us?
I think that would be it.
Eat your salad and drink your water.
Yeah.
Well, it's very generous of you to share with us how things go for you. And I also want to congratulate you on the regularity and ease with which you digest and eliminate. My wish for you is that you always have a private, quiet place to do your business.
Thank you, JC.
Thank you, Lathan. Lathan Spalding, carpenter, apprentice boat builder, former skateboarder, and dedicated meditator in the Bay Area. Our concluding poem. Things my grandmothers used to do. Both my grandmothers oiled their thin, graying hairs. One wore a pearl-studded silver hair clip at the nape of her neck. The other braided a clean plait down her back. One read several newspapers every day and got the women's vote out. She learned to swim at the age of 66. Her kids were latchkey kids before the term was invented. The other said her daily prayers, raised well-mannered children, and kept the tidiest house until the day she passed. She also always waited to eat breakfast until her colon had emptied itself. They both did hot, fresh chapatis at every meal. One always put aside the first morsel of her food for the birds. They fed their families and their guests their fill before satisfying their own hunger. They made plenty and were sure there would be no leftovers. They never served nor ate leftovers. Leftovers were fed to the cows freely roaming the streets, or to the stray dogs in the alleys, or the pigeons on the rooftop patio. They both would never, ever dream of eating mangoes alone.
ん
Beijing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website setup and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by GC Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. gypsyjace.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. Neijing Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these programs are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.